audio tape is copyrighted by Uplook Ministries to maintain the integrity of the material. Permission is granted to make copies of this tape in its entirety as long as this message is included. Additional resources may be obtained from Uplook Ministries by calling 1-800-952-2382.
All right, maybe it's 2 minutes early, but I'd like to begin anyway. We've got a lot of material to cover. If you've looked through the outline, you know that we do. We probably will not cover all of it in detail. We'll pick and choose as we go along, depending on how much time we have. But to begin with, my name is Don Graham, and our charge, as you can see by the overhead for the next hour, is to cover the subject of creation and evolution. And if either one of those facts don't meet with your approval, I guess now's the time to leave. And my kids maybe especially might leave, but what I'd like to do, I'm a physicist, by the way. John Lennox, who spoke this morning, is a mathematician. I had a great chance to talk with him last night, and he's a brilliant man. If you haven't met him and are so inclined to do so, he's a very pleasant man, a very humble man, one of the brightest guys in the world. And, you know, he studies pure mathematics. That's his research, and so he's a great guy to talk to. He knows this stuff inside and out. I'll explain that in a little bit, but get to know him. Let's have a quick word of prayer, and then we're going to read a couple verses, and then we'll start working our way through the outline. All right, let's begin with a word of prayer. Those of you just coming in, there are some outlines on the table in the back, on the counters on the side of the room. Help yourself to those. There's still several left, so make sure you grab one of those. It'll help you over the next hour. Now, Father, we thank you now for the opportunity we have to discuss this subject, and we pray that you would give us eyes that see and ears that hear, most especially wills and minds that obey. And we pray that we wouldn't take this information and use it only as head knowledge, but that we would try and conceive of some way to use it to reach out to the world and to save those that are lost. And we ask your blessing on this hour. In Jesus' name, amen. Few verses by way of beginning. First of all, in Colossians chapter 1, you needn't turn there if you don't want to. We're going to go to Genesis 1 in just a bit, and that's where we'll spend some time, not for the first half hour perhaps, but after that. But Colossians chapter 1, familiar territory, beginning in verse 16, we read these words. For by him, that's Jesus Christ, for by Jesus Christ were all things created that are in heaven and that are in earth, visible and invisible, whether they be thrones or dominions or principalities or powers. All things were created by him and for him, and he is before all things, that means above all things, and by him all things consist. Now that phrase, all things, is used twice in those two verses, and it's important. It implies that God didn't just create a few forms of life and then take his hand off and let the rest evolve. All things were created by him. And then in Genesis 1, it says, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And that's where the battle lies today, isn't it? That's where the argument is. When I got out of graduate school, I went to work for the General Electric Company, their corporate research and development center in Schenectady, New York. It so happened I was given a laboratory right across the hall from a fellow by the name of Ivar Geiver. He was Norwegian by birth, working for GE. I got there in very late 1975. In 1973, Ivar Geiver won the Nobel Prize in Physics for his work on electron tunneling. When I got there, he was off on a six-week speaking tour. While he was gone, his manager went into his laboratory and constructed a display made up primarily of all of the medals he had won, including a replica of the Nobel Prize. When Ivar Geiver got back to the laboratory, he saw what had happened. Again, he's a humble man. He ordered his three technicians out of the lab. He closed and locked the door, took a three-pound hammer, and trashed that display, just destroyed it. A humble man. And I had the opportunity to talk with him, of course, being right across the hall. And in the course of the conversations, one time he said this, I refuse to acknowledge the existence of anything superior to the human mind. A humble man, and yet that was his attitude. We're going to see there's very little evidence for evolution that exists, in spite of what you've been taught. And yet, why do people grab a hold of it so much? When Darwin first came out with the theory of evolution in 1859, he was probably the most vilified scientist that ever lived, before or since. And yet today, it's the most embraced theory. Why is that? I think the reason has to do with what Ivor Gaiver said there. We like to do away with God. If we can get rid of God, we can do anything we want. We can think anything we want. We can wear or not wear anything we want. There's a great deal of freedom there. John Lennox alluded to that this morning. And if any of you are going to take his seminar tomorrow, I think he's going to continue along that line of thinking. We want to do away with God. Man is the ultimate God, and anything against man is blasphemy against God. And so we have to do away with that. We also, when we do that, do away with the value of man. C.S. Lewis said that man has value for three reasons. Number one, the soul is eternal. That gives us value. And he went on to say that one soul is worth more than everything the earth contains because it's eternal. Secondly, man has value because Jesus Christ died for us. And thirdly, man has value because we are created in the image of God. And you take away God, you take away the value of man. And that's what the evolutionists do. And as a result of that, unborn babies have no value. Old people don't have so much value. Euthanasia is no big deal. Abortion is no big deal. And crime and so forth, you see what's happened is a result of that. John Lennox this morning said, if you see a series of steps, you ask, where are they going? In Genesis 1, they go to man. Genesis 1 and 2. Man is the high point of God's creation. And you ignore Genesis 1 and 2, you ignore creation, and you take away that value. So that's very, very significant. Now, let me pause here. And again, for those of you in the back or that have come in recently, I do have some outlines. I don't know if there are any on the table in the back yet or not, but on the counters on the side, particularly that counter in the back, there are several copies. Grab a hold of one. I should make a statement, too. There were 135 people registered here in the speakers meeting yesterday. They warned us additional people might come in. You're welcome. You're welcome to stand in the back or along the sides, wherever you can see and hear. For those of you who might be getting a bit tired and you just had lunch and all that, if you're inclined to fall asleep, I'm not going to be the least bit offended if you want to stand up and walk around to stay awake. Just trying to not get in anybody's way or cause a disturbance or disruption or whatever, and we'll be in good shape. Now, one of the things that makes this seminar so timely, and I suspect the reason I was asked to do this, is because there probably has never been a time where evolution is on the defensive as much as what it is today. And a lot of that has to do with some of the publications that have come out recently. I'm going to do a strange thing and invite you to start at the back of your outlines that you have there. You have several pages. The very last page is a list of sources on the Internet. Some of you have access to the Internet, and you may want to take a look at that. And all of a sudden, I can't find mine, but I think I remember what's there. The very first organization that's listed is Institute for Creation Research. This is the best-known group on the page. They publish a great deal. For the most part, it's good stuff. Later on, I'm going to suggest that their science is a little bit weak. Sometimes they'll take the opposing theories and create a straw man. You probably know what that is. They'll say, well, here's the gap theory, or here's progressive creationism, or here's theistic evolution. And they'll say these are the main tenets of those beliefs, and they're the weaker tenets of those beliefs, and then they attack those weaker tenets and make the opposing theories look bad. I think I can rightly accuse them of that. Their science is a little bit weak in some areas, but by and large, I think their viewpoint is the correct one, and by and large, most of what they put out is great stuff. Just read with a critical eye and be a bit cautious about that. Answers in Genesis is the second thing listed here. That's Ken Ham. A lot of you have seen his video. You've heard his recordings. A great speaker. A first cousin, maybe even a brother of these guys at ICR. Creation Research Society, quite similar. Both of the first two take a very dogmatic stand on six-day creationism, a literal 24-hour 6 days. CRS takes that stand not quite as dogmatically. Bible Science Association down below, a little bit less so. And Reasons to Believe is Hugh Ross. You've probably heard that name. He's gotten a great deal of publicity lately, writes voluminously. He holds to progressive creation. I don't think that's the right view, but a lot of the stuff that he puts out attacks evolution, and there's some benefit to you in that regard. You may want to read that. At the bottom of the page, several websites, all of them good, even Hugh Ross's, lots of good stuff on there. It's an extensive website, and you can get an awful lot of good stuff there. We're going to talk about Philip Johnson and Michael Behe in just a second. The last one there, Michael Behe, you might be a little bit disappointed there. You go to his website and all you see is a picture of him with his bald head and his white shirt unbuttoned. And he's a very pleasant guy, but that's all that there's there on that site. Okay? The next thing I want to talk about is on the next to last page. This is perhaps more significant. Now, if you haven't had a chance to go through the bookstore here, please do so. There's a lot of terrific books there. I know many of you have because I recognize your faces. I've met some of you in the past. Many of the books I'm going to talk about, I know at least three are there. It started out last night or yesterday afternoon when they put them there, stacks this high. The stacks are already down that high. So if you're thinking about getting any of these books that I'm going to discuss here, don't wait too long for fear they might be gone. You're going to get the best prices here, at least from what I've been able to find, even from Amazon. You know, that's the web bookstore. But the first book that I'll talk about is one that's written by Michael Behe. It's called Darwin's Black Box. And just to give you an advertisement, I paid $26 plus tax for my copy. You can get it downstairs for $22, a little bit cheaper. But this is a very, very significant book. Michael Behe, I don't believe, is a Christian. He is a theist, a strong believer in the existence of God. He's a Catholic. You don't read this book for theology. You're reading it for the science. It's moderately deep. The reason I asked how many of you have taken biology, if you've taken a decent course in biology, you'll be able to understand what's in here. There are certain parts that are more difficult. He highlights those, marks them off, says if you want to skip this, you're not going to miss anything significant. But basically what the book says is that there are certain systems that are irreducibly complex. And by that he means that if you take away any one of the parts, it won't operate. And I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this in about 15 minutes. But he says that vision is that way, the blood clotting system is that way, the immune system is that way. So if you're interested in the science and the biology of those things, this is a good book. If you're interested in digging deeper, a great book to get. The second book that's on that page is written by a man by the name of Philip Johnson. This man is a believer. His conversion is interesting. He's an attorney, a brilliant man. He's a law professor at Cal Berkeley, out in California. And he was the chief assistant to Earl Warren, who was Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. He got saved at 44 years of age. His daughter went to a vacation Bible school, got saved, came home and told her dad what had happened. And as a result of that, he received Christ as Savior. He's a Presbyterian. His theology is a little bit different. Again, you don't read this for the theology. You read it for other reasons. He would not hold to a literal six-day creation. He's a bit evasive as to what he does hold to. Basically, the two books that are here are written to, again, trash evolution. But I use that word trash, and it sounds flippant. This is a quality book. What it does is look at the fossil evidence. It looks at the molecular evidence, the biochemistry, and so forth. It looks at mutations. He's got a chapter in here, Mutations Great and Small. He looks at pre-biological evolution. He looks at some of the philosophy and so forth. And if you get done reading these two books, Michael Behe's and Philip Johnson, you scratch your head and say, how in the world can anybody accept evolution? These books are taken very seriously by the evolutionists. Who's the most famous evolutionist today? Does anybody know? Stephen Jay Gould, exactly. He has read these books over and over again. He has written about these books. He takes these very seriously. Again, not to be dismissive of anybody, but they'll take a look at the ICR stuff, which I think has the right view. I think their stuff is great, and he says that's weak. But this stuff, he says, is good, it's quality, and you read this stuff and understand it, and you're in good shape. There's another book written by Philip Johnson and called Defeating Darwinism. Those of you from the other side of the ocean over in Europe, it's got a different title. It's called Testing Darwinism. And in that version of the book, John Lennox, who spoke this morning, wrote the foreword. And again, Lennox, a brilliant man and a friend of both Johnson and Michael Behe, knows them well. These guys are part of a group called the Intelligent Design Group. And these are brilliant people who do not accept evolution. They're not believers for the most part. Some are. But they're good scientists, and they're questioning seriously evolution. And as I say, people like Stephen Jay Gould and Eldridge and Dawson and all these other people, Saunders, they are, you know, back on their heels a little bit right now, largely because of these publications. This one is more philosophical. he spends a bit of time talking about a movie called Inherit the Wind. It came out in 1960, starring Spencer Tracy and Gene Kelly. They're the Michael Gibson and the Tom Cruise of the day. And that movie makes Christians look bigoted and unintelligent, that they don't like education and they're prejudiced and crude and all that sort of thing. It makes the evolutionists look wise and loving and kind and cooperative and, you know, always having a quest for knowledge and so forth. And at the end of the movie, he talks about this. There is Spencer Tracy, who's the attorney for the evolutionist teacher, and he's holding Darwin's Origin of Species in one hand, in the Bible in the other hand, and he does this with a sort of weighing them, and then he puts them both in his briefcase. And the mental picture you get, or the notion that you're supposed to get, is that both Darwin and the Bible have something to offer us as long as we allow the liberal to dictate which book we'd ought to go to for what purpose. And what Johnson says is we should never let the evolutionists get to that point. Never let them frame the argument science versus the Bible. It's good science versus bad science. It's what's right versus what's wrong. That's the way you want to do it. And he encourages you to think critically, basically. Look at their arguments. Understand which ones have something to say and which ones don't. And again, if you're going to take John Lennox's session tomorrow, it's a three-part deal, an all-day thing. He is going to talk about that and cover it in some detail. All three of those books are on display and for sale down in the room downstairs. There's another one called Scientific Creationism, written by Henry Morris. This is the ICR guy. This is a good book. Again, there's a few places where it's weak because of the straw man and some of the science, but this reviews all of the technical data on the subject and promotes six-day creationism well. And this is a good book. This one has been out of print for a while. Baker has just started reprinting it. Kevin Shantz was going to try and get some of these. In fact, I thought he said that he had, but I didn't see them yesterday. Look for this. It may have a different cover, but I don't know that it's down there or not. There's another one, again, written by a Reformed theologian. I don't agree with the theology there, but R.C. Sproul, he's on the radio. You may have heard of him. Not a Chance. Basically, he says, you know, the evolutionists will say matter came about by chance or this happened by accident or whatever. He argues chance has no power to do anything. Circumstance doesn't bring anything about. And it's if you're interested in philosophy and logic and so forth, this is a good book. And then finally, The Genesis Flood. This is a classic. This is written by Morris and Whitcomb, basically a geology book. If you can find this, grab a hold of it. People will kill to get this book. Written, you know, some 40 years ago, but still good, still worth your while. I don't think there's any of those downstairs because I think it's very hard to find those in print. Okay? All right. Let me make one other introductory comment. Those were not introductory comments. Hopefully they're useful comments. But what I'd like to do for the next about 40 minutes or so is to go through the different series of beginnings that exist. And yesterday in the speakers meeting, we were encouraged to discourage questions until the end of the session. The reason being is that there are so many people here, and in particular in a session like this where there may be so many viewpoints, somebody may want to get up and start preaching their particular brand of whatever, creation or whatever. I'd like to modify that a bit. If you've got a quick question that you think can be set aside with a quick answer, raise your hand or shout at me if I've got my back to you because I'm looking at the screen or whatever, and we'll try and answer it quickly. If I can't give you an answer, maybe I can dig it up and give it to you later. I've got a whole bunch of business cards up on the podium here. If you want to write me or email me or call me or whatever later on, feel free to do that. Take these cards if you want. It's my business thing, but you can get me there. Thank you very much, by the way, for the screen. Hopefully you can see this a bit better now. But if you do have questions, why... feel free to ask them if they're quick questions. Basically, there's a lot of data out there. And so much data that even a bad theory is going to be supported by some of it. We have data from the fossil records. You can go to Wyoming or Colorado or Africa or different places in Asia, and you can find fossils, and you can find layers of fossils. So there's a great deal of data that the paleontologists have. A paleontologist is one who looks at fossils. Secondly, there are observations on species. We can study those. We know some of their characteristics. there are observations from nature, and I'm going to talk about some of those. You can look at the way creatures respond to different stimuli and changes in their environment. There's experimental data. You can work with biology and biochemistry. You can take a rose and irradiate it and change the number of petals that it has and things like that, things that you can get from the laboratory. And finally, and very importantly for probably all of us here in this room, there is the biblical record. We should never forget that the Bible is an accurate record. It is good data. It is correct data. In fact, it's the only infallible source of data that we have. And that belongs on this chart just as much as everything else. And if we were to rank these in terms of hierarchy, that would be number one. That's the thing that we want to look at. Okay? Now, there are several theories out there that purport to explain all of that data. And what we want to do for about a half hour or so is to go over those. There is atheistic evolution, and we're going to spend most of our time on that. Secondly, there is theistic evolution. If you're a Christian, you don't accept atheistic evolution because it leaves God out. And so you bring God in, call it theistic evolution. There is the gap theory, and perhaps several of you believe in that. That was popularized by the Scofield Bible. Up until, I would say, the late or early, maybe 1960s, maybe late 60s, this was the most popular view. It's been replaced now by six-day creation, but the gap theorists are still around. And John Lennox indicated the other day that a book has been published recently supporting that theory. It's been discredited quite a bit recently, but there still is some evidence for that. Progressive creation, this is the new popular one, if you will, similar to the day-age theory, although they've updated a bit. And we'll talk about that, and then finally, six-day creation. And what I'd like to do is to describe what each of those theories are, describe some of the data that support each of those theories, and then describe some of the data that questions those theories. And first of all, we'll begin with evolution. And you probably all have some concept of what evolution is. Most of us are probably most familiar with that tenet right there, the process that produces man from animal. We can describe evolution a little bit more precisely than that, though, and we'll do it this way. The basic philosophies, the basic principles of evolution are listed here. First of all, there is variation within the species. That's obvious to all of us. Here in this room, we have men and we have women. We have tall people, short people, some people who are skinnier than others. We have people that are brown, people that are white, people that are, I don't know if there's anyone who's black here or not. There are some. And variation within the species. We're all people, and yet there's variation. That's obvious. Secondly, Darwin argued that there is overproduction. The species produce more than what the environment can support. And as a result of that, he said that there's going to be survival of the fittest. In other words, there's not enough food, there's not enough whatever to support all of the individuals that are there. Some are going to die out, some are going to survive, and those that have beneficial characteristics will be the ones that survive. If we think of this in terms of basketball, I would be at a disadvantage. I'm not very tall, I'm not very big. If in order to survive I had to win basketball games, I might not survive all that long because I'm too short. And you can see how that goes into nature. There are certain characteristics that lead to survival, some that don't. There just isn't enough to go around. And then fourthly, inheritance of favorable characteristics. If basketball were the criteria of survival, pretty soon everybody would be 7 feet tall. And Darwin looked at that, not basketball, but he looked at other characteristics, and he said, look, you can see this in nature. Again, we don't question that. That sort of makes sense. But his final conclusion, his final precept was this: new species arise from the accumulation of small variations. That is the key concept of evolution, and that's the one that is debated most widely. Okay? So that's what evolution is. Again, particularly the last point, where through gradualism, new species arise. Now, Stephen Jay Gould and Eldridge have modified this a bit. We're going to talk about punctuated equilibrium shortly, but basically that's what Darwinism is. It's gradualism and better individuals arising over the process of time. Matter of fact, there's a fellow by the name of Julian Huxley. Have you heard the name Huxley? A famous family. And Thomas Huxley was a good friend of Darwin, strong supporter, I don't know if it was his son or grandson, Julian, who said this, given enough time through the process of evolution, man will produce a perfect human being. And obviously the Bible says something different. All our righteousness is filthy rags and so forth. Well, what can we say in support of evolution? Again, there's enough data out there that even a bad theory will be supported by some of it, and there are some things that might suggest evolution. I don't know if all of you can read that in the back or not. That light maybe is a little bit troublesome. But first of all, there are fossil records that might imply evolution has occurred. Different levels of rock suggest the development of life forms. In other words, you've probably seen charts that look like this. At the very bottom, you've got the Precambrian era, where you have very simple amoeba-like creatures, single-celled, very simple life forms. And that's at the very bottom of the rock layers. And then you come up a little bit, and all of a sudden, you've got what's called the Cambrian explosion. All these life forms, more complicated. The newspaper articles a few years ago put it for their headlines. They called this the biological Big Bang because of the complexity in the Cambrian era. And then you go up and up and up, and of course, because of the movie Jurassic Park, this era is famous. That's where the dinosaurs are. And you go up to the Pleistocene era where they've got the Neanderthal man and Homo erectus and all that sort of thing. But there is that data in nature. You can see that. You can collect it. You can analyze it. It's there. And secondly, you can look at that rock record and see that some species survive over millions of years unchanged. They don't change. Other species, they would argue, less suited for their environment, become extinct. There's also data from observation. You can look at man and monkey and say they have certain characteristics. The limb of the horse and the bat have similarities. There's something called vestigial organs. Do you know what those are? Those are the organs the evolutionist says the body has no use for. They're leftovers from the evolutionary process, things like tonsils and the appendix and the cecum and other things like that. They used to argue there were some, maybe somebody can correct this number, but 120-some vestigial organs in the human body. When I was a kid, if somebody had a sore throat, you went to the hospital, had the tonsils out, fed them ice cream for, you know, 2 days and sent them home minus their tonsils. The thought was tonsils have no use in the human body. Today we know that's not correct. Appendicitis. You got a side problem, you go into the hospital, get the appendix taken out. There's no reason to have that. Now today we know the appendix is part of the lymph system and it secretes a, the substance anyway, and it prevents infection in the bowel. So we know there's a purpose for it. Of those 120, whatever it was, vestigial organs, there are only about two organs today that we don't know the purpose for. And all the other ones we know. So that's pretty much been trashed. But they would look at that sort of thing. And then there's laboratory experiments, the fruit fly and the moth and all that sort of thing. And for the sake of time, I'll go over those quickly. The fruit fly, the evolutionist likes because the gestation period is so short, you can have babies very, very quickly if you're a fruit fly. And you can irradiate the fruit fly, change its environment, and see how it responds and so forth. There's Darwin's finches he made famous in his book. The peppered moth is probably one that's interesting. I'll talk about that a bit. Some of you may have heard of that. Over in England, these peppered moths, I don't know if they feed off birch trees, poplar trees, but they rest there at least, and I think they get some food there. The moths are light. And the idea is the birds fly around looking for food, and if there's a dark moth on a white tree, it's an easy target. The bird eats it up. If the moth is light-colored on a light bark, the bird doesn't see it, and so he's protected. Well, during the Industrial Revolution, with all the smoke coming out of the factories, the white trees turn dark. And now all of a sudden, these white moths are easy targets for the birds. The peppered moth population went down, but the peppered moth varied. It changed its color. It became dark, and the birds fly around. They don't see the peppered moth anymore. The peppered moth population comes back up. The Darwinist looks at that and says, here's evolution in action. Everybody can see it. It's unquestioned. What they don't tell you is that when the cities got clean and the trees got white again, the moths went back to being white again. And there's variation within the kind. It doesn't continue to move. And bacteria become resistant to antibiotics. All of that we observe, and I should have saved the punchline about the moths for later on, but all of those things, some people will say, support evolution. So that's what evolution is, suggests through the gradual process of survival of the fittest and adaptation, new species arise. The data that support it are the things that we've just talked about, but there are several problems. And in your outlines, you have something that looks like this, and I'm not going to cover all of these. If you've got questions about it afterwards, I'd be more than happy to discuss it or grab one of my cards and call me. But there are general problems, there are scientific problems, there are philosophical problems. I'm not going to talk about that very much. Philip Johnson does a great job of that in his book, and I think John Lennox is going to cover that tomorrow. But there are philosophical problems with evolution. In other words, it just doesn't make sense logically. And then finally, there are serious biblical problems with it. That's obvious. It leaves God out. And there's other issues as well that we'll talk about. General problem. First and foremost, where does matter come from? Now, John Lennox is a brilliant man. I don't pretend to talk on his level, but he and I were having this conversation last night, and we talked about articles that we had read that tried to answer that question, where does matter come from? And I'd read an article about 15 years ago written by a physicist, and basically he was arguing that somewhere in the past there was a bend in the space-time continuum. And as a result of that bend, matter formed. At the end of the article, and there was complex mathematics in it, he said, this is so improbable, nobody should accept it. But I write this article to stimulate other people's research into this area. John Lennox said he heard of an article. He's a mathematician. A mathematician wrote an article proposing that somewhere in imaginary time-space, there was an imaginary bend, and that formed matter. And John was scratching his head, and he said, now tell me what imaginary space is and imaginary time is and all that sort of thing. And of course, he works with that stuff. Those of you who have studied mathematics, you know, imaginary numbers, the square root of negative one, I've never understood that fully. I've only found what I thought was one practical use for it after school. I put it in a paper once, and the reviewers of the magazine I tried to publish my paper in it trashed that concept, so I have yet to see a practical use for the square root of negative one, but I'm sure there is some out there for those of you mathematically inclined. But where does matter come from? You've got to answer that question, and that is a real problem for the evolutionists. Now, they would argue, well, we don't purport to answer that question. All we do is say, well, here's the matter, here's where life came from. But philosophically, where does the matter come from? Secondly, where does form come from? Why do metals have crystal structure? Why is it that as you take matter and begin to break it down and break it down and break it down, you don't come to a glob of material? You know, you take a look at this and you say, well, this is wood. And, well, what's wood? You can break it down further. It's not just simple matter. You've got all those, you know, the carbon and the hydrogen and everything else in there. You come to the molecules and you say, well, that's not simple matter. You got atoms. And now you got protons and neutrons and the electrons and the mesons and the quarks and the muons and everything else and muons. And it's not simple. Why does life have form? Doesn't form presuppose a former? And let me use a couple of analogies that may not be exactly appropriate, but I think they're close enough to be useful. This is one that I steal. I think it's from Philip Johnson, certainly one of the books that I've read in preparation for this. Imagine yourself walking down the beach, and you look at the sand, and you see ripples in the sand. There's a pattern there. There's geometry there, and it's pretty. But you say to yourself, well, that's there because of the action of the waves. Nature has produced that. But you keep walking, and you see written in the sand a sentence. Wasn't the sunset beautiful last night? Do you assume that nature did that? You don't. You assume that there's intelligent design behind that. You're driving through South Dakota. You're admiring the hills and the mountains. And all of a sudden, you come to a mountain that contains the sculptures of four presidents of the United States. Do you assume that nature did that? No. You assume that there's intelligent design behind that. And that's one of Behe's arguments, Darwin's black box, by the way. He says, form... this isn't his phrase, but form presupposes a former. When you come to something like vision or the cell, the chemistry of the cell, there is so much intelligence there, to use John Lennox's phrase this morning, so much intelligence there that you've got to assume something is behind it. It's not a quirk of nature. There's the DNA molecule, and again, some of you who are chemists or biologists can do a better job of this than I can. But if you take a look at the DNA molecule, and I'm not going to do it quite precisely, you've got these strings, and there's information on that. This is overly simplistic, but you've got these bumps here of information. And people describe these as analogous to Morse code. Now, it's that pattern, this Morse code principle or whatever, that tells you what color of hair you're going to have, whether you're going to have one arm, two arms, five toes, six toes, whether you're going to be tall, short, whatever. It comes from the information on the DNA molecule. And when you come to that, you say there's intelligence there. Now, that thought, as simple as it may sound right now, is extremely profound, and that's what has a lot of these evolutionists scratching their heads and say, where in the world did that intelligence come from? Where does life come from itself? The last point here. That's a real troublesome statement. You know, you've got to go from inorganic compounds to organic compounds to proteins to amino acids and life and so forth. And a couple of those steps have been taken, right? This guy by the name of Stanley Miller in the late 50s put these chemicals in a flask, ran some lightning through it, and lo and behold, he gets some proteins. And, you know, the left-handed things, and people got all excited and said, evolution is proved. Here's how life came about. But you don't hear much about that anymore. After a lot of research in that area, basically the conclusion by the scholars in that area was life could not have occurred spontaneously on Earth. It doesn't make sense. And where does life... Let me quote you a couple of scientists here. These two are English biologists by the name of Mei-Wan Ho and Peter Saunders. I mentioned him earlier. This is what they wrote in one of their papers. It is now approximately half a century since neo-Darwinian synthesis was formulated. That's just an upgraded version of Darwinism, evolution. A great deal of research has been carried on within the paradigm it defines. Yet, the successes of the theory are limited to the minutiae of evolution, such as the adaptive changes in coloration of moths, while it has remarkably little to say on the questions which interest us most, such as how there came to be moths in the first place. That's the real problematic area for the evolutionists. Where did life come from? Does life have value? Now, in your outline, there's several more points there, and you can go through those, but all of those are problematic for the evolutionists. You know, there's no evidence of evolution in the past. I'm going to talk about that. No evolution today. We don't see it. But let's look at the science. So there are those general problems, the philosophical problems. Where does matter come from? Where does form come from? Where does life come from? Scientific problems. And we don't find a progressive record in the fossil strata, if you will. You can take a look at the layers of rock, and you can see the simple forms at the bottom, and you can see the more complex forms above that, and more complex and more complex. But what you don't see are the transitions from one to the other. That is a big, big problem. The fossil record is evolutionists' best evidence that evolution works. It's also the greatest evidence that it doesn't work. It's not just that a few gaps remain. Hundreds and thousands of gaps remain in the fossil record. To quote some of these people, Charles Darwin himself said, "Why, if species have descended from other species by insensibly fine gradations, do we not everywhere see innumerable transitional forms? Why is not all nature in confusion instead of the species being, as we see them, well defined?" In other words, why is it that it's so easy for the paleontologist to say this being belongs in that species, or this creature belongs in that species? Because there are distinctions between the species, it's not finely gradated. Just to quote Stephen Jay Gould, he said this, "I regard the failure to find a clear vector of progress in life..." Uh-oh, did I just trip that or did the bulb go out? Okay, well, we may be stuck here. I don't know if I've got an alternate, but we'll get that fixed. Anyway, let me read it to you. "I regard the failure to find a clear vector of progress in life's history is the most puzzling fact of the fossil record." It troubles him, and it ought to trouble us, and prove that another nail in the coffin, if you will, of the evolutionist. Yes. Yes. No. His friend Thomas Huxley wrote him several letters, though, and warned him what would happen if he didn't. Darwin went to his death not being able to answer that question and continually puzzled by that. But, matter of fact, I have this quote here, if I can find it quickly. I can't, but basically he warned Darwin in his private correspondence that he better account for those big jumps or his theory was in trouble. Now, as a result of that, this guy, Stephen Jay Gould, he's famous partly because he came up with Niels Eldridge of something called punctuated equilibrium. Have you heard of that? Basically, they said that because we don't see evolution in the fossil record, because we don't see these transitional forms, we've got to explain these big jumps. So what they proposed is a small family group of, say, a raccoon or whatever, went off into a corner of nature, and because of inbreeding and other, he's more complicated than that, but basically a reptile laid an egg and a bird was hatched. In other words, things happen quickly, and they call that punctuated equilibrium. And, you know, this is a bright guy. Stephen Jay Gould is brilliant. Don't assume he's nuts because he says some of this stuff. So it sounds nuts to us because we've got the Bible and accept that and so forth. But if you can get Stephen Jay Gould to write a foreword in your biological textbook, you've got a bestseller. I mean, everybody. There's a guy that goes to our chapel that's a brilliant student. He's studying biochemistry at UMass. And he says you go into most school libraries and there's a whole section devoted to Stephen Jay Gould. And yet he recognizes this as a problem and came up with punctuated equilibrium. Not everybody accepts it yet. Few do. But that's his proposal. And, you know, going back to this concept, where does life come from? There's a fellow by the name of Crick, C-R-I-C-K. You may have heard that name. He's the co-discoverer of DNA. Again, another brilliant man. What I'm going to suggest implies he might not be. He proposes the origin of life as follows. He said that somewhere in outer space, there was a civilization that was becoming extinct, and they knew they were going to die out. And so they took some bacteria, some tough bacteria, put it into a spaceship and just sent it out, hoping that somewhere, somehow it would land in some environment where it would prosper. And that's how life came to be here on this earth. I mean, those are the kinds of things that they're grasping for to explain origins. You get rid of God and you got to come up with some strange stuff to explain our existence. And that's the kind of thing that they're doing. And so in any event, there are those problems there. Let me check my time here. Skip on to biology, and I want to spend a little bit of time with this, and the popping of that bulb could not have come at a more inopportune time, I suppose, because I want to talk about Behe's irreducible complexity. I mentioned that earlier. When you read his book, you're going to come across a cartoon, and I stole it, and this, for some of the younger ones, might be the best part of the whole talk, but it's a cartoon of Calvin and Hobbes. I don't know how many of you are Calvin and Hobbes fans, but you know that Calvin is a little boy that has this box, and he can hop into the box, and he can do almost anything he wants to. One day, he grabs his stuffed tiger, Hobbes, and says, let's go back in time 140 million years. And so they jump in there and take off. Put on your vortex goggles, Calvin says to Hobbes, and you know, you see the box flying through the air. And as they're flying, Hobbes says to Calvin, answer a question for me. Why is it that as we go back in time, we're not getting younger? And when we pass the day we were born, why don't we disappear? Calvin's answer is, well, I'd explain that to you, but it involves a lot of math. And the tiger's response is, I thought you got a D in math. The point of that is that as long as we can look at something as a black box, we don't have to explain how it came about. In other words, human nature is such that we look at a black box, and by that, I mean you put something in one end and something else comes out the other end. We assume that what's going on inside that black box is relatively simple. Here in the Detroit area, you put steel and iron and cloth in one end, and out of the black box, the factory comes a car. And, well, we assume everything that goes on inside that factory is pretty simple. I was very upset one time. The president of our corporation was sitting through a discussion of our research activities, and we were describing our stuff, what we were doing, trying to impress him. And he says, you don't have to tell me all that. I can describe that to you in one sentence. You put this stuff in the black box, and this stuff comes out. That's all I need to know. Don't go into all this detail. It's irrelevant. And that's what the evolutionists would do up until the point that the electron microscope became available. They would look at things like the eye, and they would look at the cell, and they would look at enzymes. And they would say those are black boxes, and what goes on inside there must be simple.
But here comes all these fancy microscopes, and all of a sudden we realize it's not simple, it's complex. And just to show you how technically sophisticated Behe's book is,
Here's figure number, I don't know, 4 or 5. I don't know if you can see it or not, but it's a simple mousetrap. And he said this is a good example of an irreducibly complex system. Now, let me describe this, because it's easier to understand a mousetrap than it is vision or blood clotting or something like that. Vision, you know, a couple of the enzymes and proteins in there, they process and interpret enough data in a microsecond that would take the biggest Cray supercomputer today about a half hour to do. I mean, that's how complex the eye is. But what he says is that a mousetrap consists of 5 basic units. It has a platform. It has a spring. It has a holding bar. You know that thing you bring over to clip into the catch? That's the 4th thing, and then a hammer. Now, his question is, how could a mousetrap have evolved from a simpler system? If you take away any of those 5 components, you've got a useless piece of apparatus. You take away the platform. What is the hammer, the catch, the spring, and the holding bar going to do for you? Did they catch 10 mice? And then, well, if we have a platform, we're going to catch 20. It makes it a better system. You know, you can't envision that when you think about it. Apart from any one of those 5 components, it's useless. The eye is the same way. There are proteins in the eye that have no other function, no other use. How could those have evolved through gradual gradation? You know, the evolutionist says, well, 10% of an eye is better than no eye. And what they mean by that is 10% of vision is better than no vision. That's not the way the eye works. You take out a protein, you've got zero vision. Now, you take out some of these components of the eye, these here 5, in the eye there's more, you take out any one of those, you've got zero vision. Now, explain how evolution could have brought vision to pass. And he goes on and describes these Rube Goldberg machines. If you've ever watched the cartoons, Foggy Leghorn, you know, uses this analogy. The little chick comes to visit and is an irritant to the big gruff chicken, and the big gruff chicken tries to pick on him, and this little chick gets out the pad and scratches off some complex mathematical equations and then goes and builds this complex system. And the big chicken goes walking along and hits a rope, and the rope pulls over a tree, and the tree hits a teeter-totter, and the teeter-totter throws a basketball up in the air, and the basketball comes down in a funnel and comes down and hits something else and hits something else. And then eventually string pulls and starts a saw, and the saw cuts the tree, and the tree comes over and crushes the big chicken, Leghorn. And what he says is that the blood clotting system is like that. You take away any one of those components and your blood will not clot. And that's a real problem for people who have that disease. And he says, explain how that system could have arisen through the process of evolution. It just doesn't. Ah, here we go. Maybe we'll get our cartoon after all. And I don't know if the cord is long enough, but we'll see what we can do. And so that's a real problem there. And you can go through and you can see the geological problems listed there. A lot of people talk about the age of rocks. And you've probably heard scenarios like this. The people will measure the age of a snail. For example, the snail is living, and yet when you do the radiometric testing of the snail, it says it died 1,300 years ago. There are serious errors and complications in dating. And the guys from ICR, Institute for Creation Research, do a great job of reviewing that stuff. Okay, no problem. Yep, no problem. No problem. And, see if it's... maybe better than mine, eh? But another example, just while we're getting a train of thought back here, is out in Hawaii, where there was the volcano. They know lava is 200 years old. They measure it with their methods, and it turns out to be 30 million years old. And so there's a great deal of error in their processes. Now, I don't want to be dogmatic that the Earth is very, very young. I think it is. I believe that there's a lot of data that supports it, but they have some of the best, Institute for Creation Research. And then there's physics problems. This is where I love to dwell, but I think we better move on. There's the first and second laws of thermodynamics. If there's any law that's inviolate, it would be these two. Basically, the first one is conservation of law, mass and energy, rather. Nothing is being created now. Nothing is being destroyed. The second law says it may change its form. It becomes more and more disoriented. Entropy increases. Those of you from high school physics class know what entropy is. We take a drop of perfume and we put it on the table up here. In a few minutes, all of you will be able to smell that. Why? Because the atoms are vibrating and they're moving, the molecules, I should say, and it's distributed throughout the room. And all of us can smell that. Well, the universe is undergoing that. It's the entropy is increasing, the disorder, the randomness is increasing. So basically what you have, just to summarize things, and I realize we're going very quickly, the second law requires the universe to have had a beginning. You got to go back to where there was perfect order. But the first law says it didn't begin by itself because of conservation of mass and energy, matter and energy. Something had to have started it, and that's the real dilemma of the evolutionists. So, and there's other things that you've, if you've read much, and this is an overhead I put together long ago and should have redone, but the depth of the dust on the moon, you know that when the guys landed on the moon in 1969, they expected some 50 inches of dust based on the age, the assumed age of the moon. When they got there was just a little bit, and that puzzled everybody. It implies a young universe. All these other things, we talked about irreducible complexity, but nature and so forth. And you gave me that cartoon deck. I should put that up, I suppose. But yes. Yeah. The question here is, what's the difference between a closed system and an open system? The first and second laws technically operate in closed systems. And in open systems, you can do work. You can put things in, take things out. And how do you handle the evolutionist there? There's a lot of arguments in that regard. If you take the whole universe as your closed system, then nothing is being created or destroyed in the whole universe. I'm trying to think of an analogy of putting work in and getting something better out. There's about six or seven arguments you can use in that regard, but basically what it says is that unless you do work, unless you do something definitive, put in heat, put in energy, put in work of some sort, the first and second laws still operate, and it's still a real serious problem for the evolutionists, those two laws. There's still legitimate concerns. There's the cartoon for those of you that like it. There's no way you're going to read that in the back, but you can see the box flying through the air at least. And appreciate Calvin and Hobbes. So, and then mathematics, the probabilities. And John Lennox talked about that, the Encyclopedia Britannica and so forth. I think Carl Sagan said that the nucleus of a living cell contains enough information to fill up 4,000 complete sets of Encyclopedia Britannica. That's just the nucleus of the cell. And some statistics, John Lennox stole the one that I was going to use this morning. I'll see if I can find another one here on probability of creating order out of disorder. And for example, if you wanted to type the title Encyclopedia Britannica by taking monkeys and putting them in the room with the typewriters that he talked about this morning, if it's just lowercase letters, you don't care whether it's capital, little, just get the letters in the right order to spell Encyclopedia Britannica. If they can type three letters a second, just in order to bring order using random processes, this is statistics now, it would take 100,000 billion billion monkey years just to type the title. Now, think about how much more information is in the nucleus of that cell, and you can see the problem that they have. And then the biblical problem, of course, it leaves God out. And creation is assumed throughout the Bible, by the way. Genesis 1, Job, chapters 37 and 38. Zillions of questions about creation, all pointing to God as a creator. Psalm 139, Psalm 104, lots of places in the Psalms. John 1, Colossians 1, Revelation 14. Creation is important theologically. And if we have time, which we're not going to, obviously, I'd come back to that point, but that's very significant. Okay, what about theistic evolution? That assumes that the process of evolution is an established fact. It assumes the Bible is figuratively true, not literally true, but figuratively. Liberals have this viewpoint. It assumes that God exists and started everything, just started life and then took his hands off and let things go. Now, the thing that supports that is that evolution is presumed to be correct there, and as we've seen, that's a problem. And they also argue that God usually works within the bounds of natural law. In other words, miracles are the exception. You've got miracles that we would say creation, they say forget that. You've got miracles at the time of Moses, Elijah, and Elisha, Jesus and the apostles, and that's it. You don't see miracles anywhere else. So God usually operates via the process of natural laws. But what are the problems with that? Evolution is far from proven. Secondly, God is not inefficient and mistake-prone. You take a look at evolution, and there's lots of mistakes, lots of corrections, lots of things becoming extinct and so forth, and God is not that way. He's a God of order and so forth. Secondly, God is involved in the details of life. We talked about Job, but let me just read a couple of verses there quickly in Job 38 and 39. If I can get there quickly in verse 4. It says, after it a voice roareth, he thundereth with the voice of his excellency, and he will not stay them when his voice is heard. Let me skip down to verse 6. Job 37, verse 6, and he saith to the snow, be thou on the earth. Likewise to the small rain and to the great rain. If you drove through snow on the way here, those of you from New York, God caused that snow to fall. God is involved in the tiniest details of life. Not just with, you know, starting things and taking his hands off. I think in your outline, I referenced a couple things in the Sermon on the Mount. He takes care of the sparrows. He takes care of, clothes the, you know, the plants, the lilies of the field, and so forth. He knows every sparrow that falls. Evolution of man and woman is inconsistent with Genesis 2. It's very clear God took a very direct hand in the creation of man and woman. Even if you could argue that he started life and took his hand off, and all the other things of Genesis 1 happened by themselves, you can't argue that with man and woman. And then finally, the singularity of Adam in Romans 5 and 1 Corinthians 15, they see Adam as a distinct individual. He's unique. He's held responsible for his action. He's not a class of individual. He's not a, you know, certain being, and so forth. There is progressive creation. And this is a popular movement. The earth is assumed to be old. The earth is created in stage corresponding to the days of Genesis 1. In other words, in Genesis 1 and 2, you have the Big Bang. Genesis chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. The Big Bang. And then on and on it goes. And what they say is that God acted deliberately at several points. In other words, the theist would say God started everything and took his hand off. The progressive creationist would say God started this, allowed things to go, but at specific points, he operated deliberately and specifically. Now, what is the evidence for that? There is some. And again, I don't hold strongly to this view. I don't hold to it at all, but here's the data. First of all, the use of the word created is, in Genesis chapter 1, just three times. Every other time, you see the phrase, and God said, let there be. And the people who hold to this, Hugh Ross and all of the others, James Boyce out of, you know, Philadelphia and these other people, they would say, and God said, let there be. He is allowing time and adaptation to bring about these other creatures. Okay? And the same data that would support evolution would support this theory as well, the fact that the earth is old and the fossil records and so forth. Okay? What is the problem with this? There are several. First of all, you don't see simple and complex plants in the same strata. In other words, if you say, well, on day such and such, God created all the green stuff, you would expect to find simple plants and complex oak trees in the same strata. You really don't. You see the simple stuff, and then higher you see the more complicated stuff. I'll come back to that later on, because there's a problem there with six-day creationism as well. A non-literal day is assumed, and that's a real problem. If you're at Genesis 1, take a look at some of these verses. In verse 5, at the end of verse 5, and the evening and the morning were the first day. Verse 6, 8 rather, the evening and the morning were the second day. Verse 13, the third day. Evening and morning, what does that sound like? The most natural reading is a literal day. And we'll come back to that point a little bit later on. The biggest problem, though, is that it assumes death before the fall. And we know from Romans that death came about because of Adam's sin. And in Genesis chapter 1, in verse 30, it says at the end, I have given every green herb for meat. And it was so. The animals ate vegetables then. They ate green stuff. They didn't kill each other to survive. That did not happen until after Adam fell. And that's a serious flaw with progressive creationism. Okay? Probably the biggest flaw. And they try to argue around that by saying, well, it really refers to, you could argue that it could refer to Satan's fall, or that death doesn't have the trauma for the animals and so forth. But even the progressive creationists recognize this as a serious problem. And then there's the gap theory, and perhaps there are some here who hold to that. The argument is that the Earth is old. That's the assumption. I mean, there's all these radiometric dating, and there's the red shift in from the astronomers, and on it goes. They argue that there's a gap between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2, that there were long ages between the two verses represented by layers of sediment, and then there was some major cataclysm brought about because of the judgment on Satan. And there is some data that supports that. This is more sound from a biblical standpoint than all the others, except for what I think is the right one. There's some data that supports that. They do take a literal interpretation of the Bible. Exegetical study. Let me spend a moment on this one. Punctuation between the first two verses. What they would argue is at the end of verse 1, there is a little thing called a rabia. That's only in one text, the Masoretic text. You may have heard that term, one of the old texts. And it's a bit of punctuation that is analogous to the word selah in the Psalms. In other words, it means step back and take a pause, look things over. Think about what's just been said or what's just been written. They would argue that because of that punctuation point there in the Masoretic text, you can argue there's a gap. And they would look at the structure of Genesis chapter 1 and the way it's outlined and so forth. And then the Hebrew word hayah in verse 2, it says, and the earth was without form and void. It was, is that word, did it become without form and void? And it's a little bit difficult to interpret that word, and we don't have the time to go through that now, but let me stop there. But they do argue that that word could be rendered, it became without form and became void. The word, the earth rather, became. Okay? And then finally, they would argue without form and void vis-a-vis Isaiah 45:18, and there it says God doesn't create things that way. And if I can find this quickly, I'll read it to you, Isaiah 45, verse 18. And I think that's in your outline there, so you've got it for future reference. But it says, for thus saith the Lord that created the heavens, God himself that formed the earth and made it, he hath established it, he created it, not in vain. He formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord, and there is none else. So the idea is that without form and void is inconsistent with the way that God would have created. Now, there's probably... Yeah. Again, the exegetical data, the grammar is weak there. The best way to render that is the way it's here, that created means out of nothing. Again, that's the kind of argument that the people who study these words that are experts in Greek and Hebrew here would bandy about. But the best way to render it, the most common way to render it, is the way that it's created out of nothing. And I can give you some references on some of the Hebrew stuff there if you'd like to get them. And the gap theory, again, predicts death before sin because you've got all these fossils that are created there between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2. The proposed cataclysm would have destroyed that evidence. Apart from Noah's flood, there's no mention of any catastrophe in the Bible. And that's serious. Noah's flood gets a lot of attention, and yet there's no mention of anything between 1:1 and 1:2. Yes. Right. Yeah. The question was, what about the fossils? Are the gap theorists saying that those fossils were created between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2? Was the earth populated then? The answer is yes. They assume that there was a pre-existing world there and that it was all wiped out because of Satan's sin. There are other branches of that theory. Deviance from that a little bit, but basically that's the idea here. Genesis 20 verse 11, this is out of the Ten Commandments. Why do we keep the Sabbath? Because God created the world in 6 days. He worked for 6 days and then rested. The way you take that is 6 literal days. Most natural reading doesn't imply a gap. In other words, this text here, going back to the question about the Hebrew wording, the most natural reading of that is that God is telling us where the earth came from recently, not far in the past in a recreation. The most natural reading doesn't imply a gap. The exegetical data, that punctuation and stuff is very weak. None of the other texts have that rabia, and the best reading, so forth. Darkness after the judgment precludes the development of life. I think I expand on this in the outline, but darkness came as a result of the judgment on Satan. Excuse me. And if darkness is there, where is life going to come from? Life was progressing according to the fossil record, not dying out. With darkness, it's going to die out. So there are some serious problems there. Six-day creation. This is one that we're probably most familiar with, that the earth was created in six literal days, a young earth, anywhere from, say, 10 to 20,000 years. Different people assume different things. The fossil layers were a result of the flood. Assumes Genesis is literal. This takes the most natural reading of the whole scripture. And for all of those reasons, and more besides here, by the way, I just did that myself. That's not a mechanical problem. That's a brain problem, dexterity problem. Let me move on here. But the most literal rendering of Genesis, again, this word Yam, you've probably heard this talked about going back to Hebrew. While we acknowledge the fact that it is translated ages in other places, out of the 700 times it's used, 12 times it's translated ages. The other 688 times it's translated day, a 24-hour day, so it makes the most sense to assume that. Repeated morning and evening, those phrases that I pointed out. When you read that, the morning and evening of the first day, the second day, the third day, you assume what? 24-hour days. God doesn't try to hide things. If he wanted us to assume a gap or long ages or something like that, seems to me he would have given us more here. First and second law of thermodynamics, we've talked about that. Fossil facts, these people, and myself included, would argue that everything that we see in the fossil record can easily be accounted for based on the Genesis flood. And you see that supported by the Mount St. Helens explosion, new fossil beds being created, coal being formed, and all that sort of thing. There's work done on that. But having said all of that, there are a couple of problems here. The expanding universe, the fact that there's a red shift, you may not know what that is. The analogy of the train and the Doppler effect here. If a train is coming toward you, the sound of the horn is higher. If it's going away from you, it's lower because of the sound waves being compressed and so forth. Light waves do the same thing. If the universe is expanding, there's a red shift, and we can measure the rate at which it expands and the fact that it is growing and so forth. And how do you explain that based on a literal six-day creation? There's some problems there. And the plants, as I said earlier, simple plants are at the lowest level, complex plants at the highest level. People attempt to explain that, but I don't think satisfactorily. And so I think you've got to explain these things in order to handle six-day creationism. But I think the view is correct. There's just a couple of problems, and maybe in time we'll work those out. Why, then, doesn't everybody accept it? Creation in particular. Again, I think they want to get rid of God. And let me close with one other illustration here. I, being involved in science, published papers, have patents and that sort of thing. There was a time where one of our patents was challenged by a competitor of ours. And we were working for General Electric. GE spends fortunes on lawyers. We got the best lawyer we could find in patent matters, Park City, New York, Park Avenue, New York City, the kind of guy that just doesn't lose. It doesn't matter whether you're going to the kid's Little League baseball game. If his kid strikes out watching a pitch go by, he'll scream at the umpire, "Why in the world did you call that a strike? It's outside. Nobody could have hit that. You're incompetent. The next call you ought to make ought to be for a taxi." And, I mean, we saw him do that when we were out in New York City. And then he goes over to his kid on the bench and says, "How in the world? Don't you know you don't let a ball go by if you got two strikes? That was right down the middle of the plate. Why aren't you swinging?" And he took us to one of his basketball games. And attorneys, these are guys that make $3 million a year back in the early 80s. And, you know, expensive suits and the whole, but you think they're going to be cultured, sophisticated. I have never seen a bloodier basketball game in my life. Massive egos. These guys just won't lose. He worked us like maniacs, too, from like 6 in the morning till 11 at night every day for 3 weeks straight. One day he brought in a stack of legal pads to fill it up with questions. We're going to put their chief technical guy on the stand. I need lots of questions. So we did that. Monday morning comes, 9 o'clock in the morning. We put their chief scientist on the stand. He begins to ask questions. Who are you? What's your education? Publications? Made this guy sound brilliant. And then he begins to ask the important questions. Question number 4 was key. And he asks, gets the answer. Then all day Monday, all day Tuesday, all day Wednesday, till 2 o'clock Wednesday afternoon, he asks all these padded questions. 2 o'clock Wednesday afternoon, he asks question 4 again. The same words. And the guy gives an answer. In essence, the answer meant the same. But when he's doing it, he had a notebook like this in his hands with his pad on top, filled with loose paper. He's walking back and forth across in front of the room. The guy gives his answer. Our attorney goes ballistic. He throws the notebook up in the air. Papers fly everywhere. He goes over to the table where the witness is sitting, slaps his hand on it, says, "What are you, a complete idiot or a pathological liar? I asked you this question 9 o'clock Monday morning. Here's your answer." Walks to his assistant, snaps the paper out of his hand, said, "Here's your answer. Now your answer is this. Which one am I supposed to believe?" The answer was in essence the same. Different words. The judge was not technical, didn't know that, and the lawyer says, "I've got no more use for you, you're dismissed," and trashed his credibility. Now, we deserve to win the case. There's no doubt in my mind about that, but the way we won it was very questionable. That is what the evolutionists will do today. Whether it's in Melvindale here in Michigan, where the school board tries to bring in creationism as an alternative theory, not teaching religion or anybody's God or whatever, the evolutionists will scream. They'll throw the notebooks in the air and says, "What are you, complete idiots?" And we've got to be careful about that. Never let them say it's science against the Bible. And well, anyway, I've gone over time. Quick word of prayer, and you can go on to your other seminars, and other people are going to use this room, so we need to quit. But again, if you've got questions, my next seminar is right here, so I'm going to stay here. Grab a card if you want to call me, or look at me in the hall or whatever it may be, and I'd be more than happy to talk some of this over with you. So there it is, creation, evolution, very little data to support it in spite of what you've been taught and heard, and you've heard some of the quotes from the evolutionists themselves. So let's have a word of prayer, and then we'll go. Father, we thank you for your word, and we thank you that it's your word. It's not the word of man. Help us to understand that it can be relied on, that it's a sufficient book, that it's inspired. And we thank you for your care and concern of us. We thank you that you've given us this book for our benefit. Help us again to go from here with an obedient attitude, again, looking for a way to reach our world with this information. Confirm our faith. We ask all of this in Jesus' name. Amen.